Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Doctrine of God, Part 5. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We've been talking about divine eternity. And last time, after surveying the scriptural data, we began to try to make sense of it. And we saw that while the scripture teaches clearly that God is without beginning and without end, that he exists permanently, that he never came into being and never will go out of being, nevertheless, it's not clear as to whether we should understand God as existing timelessly, that is to say, outside of time, or whether we should think of God as existing everlastingly throughout time. Does God have a past, a present, and a future, which extends into the infinite past and into the infinite future? Or does God have no past, present, and future at all? Is he simply beyond the dimension of time? And we pointed out in response to questions last week that these are contradictories to each other. To say that God exists timelessly is simply to say he does not exist in time. So it's not a both-and proposition unless you can provide some way of qualifying this, because these are contradictory with each other. Either exists timelessly or he exists temporally. And the question is, how should we best understand this? Now, in order to settle this question, we want to look at some arguments for divine timelessness and divine temporality, respectively. Let's first talk about an argument for divine timelessness. In my book, Time and Eternity, I survey what I think are the best or most promising arguments for divine timelessness, and I find that most of these are, frankly, very implausible or weak arguments, with the exception of one, and this is the argument based on the incompleteness of temporal life. The idea here is that a temporal mode of existence is by its very nature a defective mode of existence. One has only the brief, fleeting present. The future is not yet, and one does not yet possess one's future. The past is gone, irretrievably lost. And so all one has is one's present. And that is ever-changing, ever-passing away, no permanence, so that a temporal being cannot possess his life all at once. By contrast, a being which is timeless, which is outside of time, possesses all of its life at once. It simply has no past, present, or future. It just has the timeless existing state in which it is. It has its life all at once. And the claim is that this is a more perfect mode of existence. And since God is the most perfect being, it would be incompatible with God to have a defective mode of existence, and therefore God cannot exist temporally. The defective nature of temporal life was brought home to me very powerfully a number of years ago when our children, Charity and John, were small, and I was reading to them after dinner one evening. I had a habit after supper each night of reading to the children on the couch in the living room. And we were reading Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, Little House in the Big Woods. And as we came to the end of that book, I read to them aloud the following passage, which for me, who was studying the doctrine of divine eternity and time, was just shattering. It didn't have this impact on Charity and John. But to me, this passage just spoke volumes. And this is how the book ends. The long winter evenings of firelight and music had come again. Pa's sweet, strong voice was softly singing. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and the days of auld lang syne? And the days of auld lang syne, my friend, and the days of auld lang syne. Should old acquaintance be forgot and the days of auld lang syne? When the fiddle had stopped singing, Laura called out softly, "What are days of auld lang syne, Pa?" "They are the days of a long time ago, Laura," Pa said. "Go to sleep now." But Laura lay awake a little while, listening to Pa's fiddle softly playing. and to the lonely sound of the wind in the big woods. She looked at Pa sitting on the bench by the hearth, the firelight gleaming on his brown hair and beard and glistening on the honey brown fiddle. She looked at Ma, gently rocking and knitting. She thought to herself, this is now. She was glad that the cozy house and Ma and Pa and the firelight and the music were now. They could never be forgotten, she thought, because now is now. They can never be a long time ago. And what's so poignant about that passage, of course, is that that time, which for Laura Ingalls Wilder was so real, so present, now is long ago. Ma and Pa are gone. They're dead. The American frontier, which they struggled to win, is gone. Laura Ingalls Wilder herself is gone, gone forever. Time has a savage way of gnawing away at existence, claiming everything that exists and taking it into the past where it's irretrievably gone, lost forever, never to be reclaimed. And the argument here is that such a defective mode of existence is surely incompatible with the existence of a perfect being. And therefore, a perfect being cannot exist temporally, but must exist transtemporally or timelessly. Now, I don't think that this is a knockdown argument for divine timelessness, but I do think it appeals to very powerful intuitions about the transitoriness and ephemeralness of temporal life. And therefore, in the absence of any counterbalancing arguments for divine temporality, I think it could justifiably motivate a doctrine of divine timelessness. However, it does seem to me that there are also good arguments on the other side. Let me look first at the argument on your outline under B, the argument for God's, or under C rather, the argument for God's being everlasting, based on his changing relations with the world. God is a God who acts in history. He is causally related to events in time, first causing one event, then causing another event after that, then causing another event after that. God is intimately involved in the temporal process. He parts the Red Sea. He calls the children of Israel out of Egypt. He sends Christ into the world. The incarnation of the second person of the Trinity is an especially problematic doctrine for those who think that God is timeless. Because here God himself enters into human history in the person of Christ. It seems self-evident that there was a time before which the second person of the Trinity had a human nature. There was a time when the second person of the Trinity was not yet incarnate, and then there was a time after which the second person of the Trinity was intimately united to a human nature and incarnate as Jesus of Nazareth. So that it would seem that from God's changing relations with the world, that he would have to be in time, because anything that changes has a before and an after. It experiences a before and an after, and that just is to be in time. Let me throw in one other argument for you here that's not listed on the outline for divine temporality that I think is easy to understand and also very powerful. This would be an argument based upon God's omniscience. As an omniscient being, God must know all truths. He must know all the facts that there are. But there are clearly truths which are tensed truths. Sentences are not in just tenseless modes. They have tense to them. Future tense, past tense, present tense, and other tenses. And God must know these tensed truths if he is truly omniscient. For example, God must know that Christopher Columbus discovered America in 1492. But at one time, that wasn't true. In 1490, it was true that Christopher Columbus will discover America. And God must have known that truth. But if God knows these tensed truths, then that means that his knowledge is constantly changing as future tense truths become false And the present tense version becomes true. Christopher Columbus will discover America was true at one time. Then it became false, and it became true that Christopher Columbus is discovering America. Then that became false, and the past tense truth, Christopher Columbus discovered, past tense, America, became true. So that God's knowledge would be constantly changing, and therefore he would be in time. So it seems to me that both of these arguments, the argument from God's changing relations to the temporal world, and the argument from God's knowledge of constantly changing tense truths, provides very powerful arguments for God's being in time. Now, how shall we evaluate these arguments? That's D on the outline. It seems to me that how we evaluate these arguments is largely going to depend upon our view of time. I think that how you construe God's eternity will stand or fall with your understanding of the nature of time. Philosophers have distinguished two views of time, which are often conveniently called the A theory and the B theory. Those initials don't stand for anything, they're just a handy way of categorizing them, the A theory and the B theory. Sometimes these are called the tensed theory of time. The A theory is called the tensed theory, and the B theory is sometimes called the tenseless theory of time. Sometimes the A theory is referred to as the dynamic theory of time, and the B theory is called the static theory of time. Well, what are these theories? Well, according to the A theory of time, events are ordered as past, present, and future. And the only thing that really exists is the present moment. The future is purely potential. It does not yet exist. It hasn't come into being. The past no longer exists. It once did exist, but it has now passed away. So there is an objective difference between the past, the present, and the future in terms of their reality. Things in the future and the past are not real. Only things in the present are real. And on this view, temporal becoming is a real and objective feature of the world. Things come into being, and they go out of being. Temporal becoming is a real and objective feature of the world. Now, by contrast, the B theory of time says that the difference between past, present, and future is just a subjective illusion of human consciousness. In fact, all events in time, whether past, present, or future, are equally real. So that there is no objective difference between the past, the present, and the future. It's just a matter of your subjective viewpoint. For the people in 2008, the events of 2008 are present, and the events of 2050 are future. But for the people in 2050, who are just as real as we are, the events of 2050 are real and present, but the events of 2008 are past. So what is past or present or future on this view is just a matter of your subjective perspective. In reality, everything is equally real, whether past, present, or future, and temporal becoming is just an illusion of human consciousness. So we are victims, in a sense, of a massive illusion on the B theory of time, insofar as we think that things really come to exist and cease to exist. Really, things don't come into being or cease to be. They all exist at their respective stations on the timeline, and they're all equally real and there, and we just have the illusion that we're sort of moving along the timeline, but in fact, we're not. There's no dynamic nature to this picture at all. The notion of moving time or becoming is just illusory. Now, it seems to me that whether you think that God is temporal or timeless will stand or fall on whether you adopt an A theory of time or a B theory of time. If you believe in the existence of God on the A theory of time, then God cannot be equally present to the past and the future, because those things don't exist. They're simply unreal. What he is related to causally is the present event. He is causing the present events to exist, and he conserves them in being. And tomorrow he will cause different events to occur and sustain them in being, and so on and so forth. But the only events to which God is causally related are the present events. Moreover, as we saw on the A theory, there are these tensed truths that are constantly changing. God knows that the 2008 election is currently being taking place. He knows that the 1980 election is already over, and that the election in 2012 has not yet occurred. So on the A theory, it seems to me that you've got to say that God exists in time because of his changing relations with the world and his knowledge of tense facts. By contrast, if you adopt a B theory of time, then it's very easy to see how God would exist outside of time, and he can be causally related to every event in time because they're all equally real. He, from his eternal timeless standpoint, is causing the parting of the Red Sea. He's causing the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. He's causing the second coming of Christ. Everything is equally real, and God, outside of time, simply sustains them all in being. There is no temporal becoming. There is no change in that sense. Moreover, on the B theory, there are no tenseless truths. We may have tensed sentences, but our English sentences, which are tense, are just our subjective ways of expressing what is, in fact, really the tenseless truth that in 1492, Columbus discovers America. And the verb there, discovers, isn't present tense, it's just tenseless. So our tense sentences express tenseless truths. For example, the truth that Hillary Clinton lost the primary could be expressed by saying Hillary Clinton loses the 2008 primary. And that's a tenseless sentence. But the tense of the verb is just an illusion. An analogy would be on the B theory, to say that something is occurring now is kind of like saying it's occurring here. You see, there is no objective place called here. For us in this room, the Magnolia Room is here, or the Fellowship Hall is here, and the sanctuary is there. But for the people in the sanctuary is here, and we are there. So that there isn't any objective place in the world called here. That's just in a subjective viewpoint. Similarly, for the now, there is no now on this view. It's just an illusion of your personal consciousness, and so on this view, there are no tense truths for God to know. All God knows is all of these tenseless facts about what occurs at certain dates and times. Now, well, let me go ahead and complete this, and then we'll have discussion. How do you decide, then, between these two views, if I'm right, that your view of God's eternity is going to stand or fall with whether you adopt the A theory or the B theory? How should we decide? Well, everybody in this debate admits that the A theory is the common sense view of time. The average person thinks that there's a difference between past, present, and future, that things do come into existence and do go out of existence. Everybody, even B theorists, acknowledge that the common sense view is the A theory. The A theory is deeply rooted in our experience of temporal becoming. We not only experience temporal becoming in the world around us as we see change and flux all around us, but even in the interior world of consciousness, we experience the becoming of mental events as we experience a stream of consciousness of one thought occurring after another, a stream of consciousness that is wholly independent of the external world. So there is nothing that I think could be more intimate to us than the experience of temporal becoming. Even our experience of the external world cannot be compared to the intimacy and the clarity of our experience of temporal becoming, because we experience not only the becoming of the external world, but even the interior world of the life of the mind as we experience a stream of consciousness. So the B theorist would have to give us very powerful reasons for abandoning this common sense view of time and denying our intimate experience of temporal becoming and tense. And I would simply say that my reasoned judgment is that there is no good reason to deny that experience. And if you're interested in pursuing this further, take a look at my book, Time and Eternity, where in a couple of chapters I look at the principal arguments for and against the A theory and for and against the B theory. And I don't think there are any good reasons for thinking that our experience of temporal reality is illusory and that we should deny it. So, philosophically, I don't see any good reason to adopt a B theory. Moreover, I think that the B theory is theologically objectionable on a number of grounds as well. I think there are problems with it theologically. For one thing, it emasculates the Christian doctrine of creation. I take it to be essential to the Christian doctrine of creation that there is a state of affairs in the actual world which consists of God existing alone without the universe, and that he then brings the universe into being. But that, on the B theory, is false. On the B theory, God never brings the universe into existence because temporal becoming is illusory. Rather, God just exists timelessly, and the universe exists co-eternally with God. The difference between God and the universe is that the universe has an internal dimension called time, which structures the events as earlier and later. But viewed from an external standpoint, the universe exists just as timelessly as God. It's just there with God. And he never actually brings it into being, which seems to me to emasculate the Christian doctrine of creation out of nothing, which surely does teach that God existed alone and then brought the universe into being. Moreover, think of the problem of evil on the B theory of time and what implications this has. What it means, for example, is that all the evil and the sin in the world is never really done away with. The stain of evil is still indelibly there. Someday Christ will come again, and then thereafter there will be no more evil. But all the evil that existed previously never ceases to exist. It's never really annihilated or done away with. Indeed, in one sense, Christ still hangs on the cross on this view. Now, granted, thereafter there's his resurrection, but the event of the crucifixion is just as real as the event of the resurrection. Christ is timelessly on the cross, in a sense, on this view, which is surely theologically very problematic. I think we want to say that evil will be vanquished, that it will be done with, and God will say, thank goodness that's over, so to speak. That evil will be done and finished with. So I think that we have no good reason philosophically for adopting the B theory. We have good theological reasons for opposing the B theory, and therefore I cast my lot with the A theory of time. Now, how should we understand then God's eternity? Here I want to make a proposal then. Here's a view that I think can unite both of the arguments that we've seen so far. I want to suggest that we understand God's eternity to mean that God is timeless without creation, and he is temporal subsequent to the moment of creation. God is timeless without creation, existing alone, without the universe. God exists timelessly. With the creation of the world, time begins, and God enters into time in virtue of his changing relationships with the temporal world and his knowledge of tense truth. So, in a sense, I come back to the model that Gabe wanted to suggest last week, where he says, couldn't God be both? I said, not both unless you qualify it. But I think we can qualify it. We can say, yes, God is timeless without creation, and he's temporal with creation. And that makes sense of the passage in Jude, which you remember says, to God, our, the Creator, be dominion, power, majesty, and authority before all time, and now, and forever. That's a way of expressing in ordinary language God's existing timelessly without creation. Time then begins, and God now and forever exists then in time. Okay, any comments or questions? Okay, yeah. I wanted to get it all out on the table. Let's go to David Rhodes here first. I wanted to get it out all on the table rather than have questions that would be based on partial information.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, I'm not... not convinced that because God interacts in time, that in fact he's bound by time. So let me give a spatial example, because I can't think of a time something an analogy to time. But for instance, if you think of a piece of paper on the table that is two-dimensional, then I could be above that piece of paper and scribe things on the paper such that the two dimensions is changed and interacted with, yet at the same time I'm in the third dimension that the paper has no access to, but that in and of itself doesn't bind me to the two dimensions.
Right.
So in the same way, why is God interacting with time? How does that bind him to time?
Okay, here I've tried to draw David's illustration where we have a two-dimensional piece of paper and a three-dimensional pencil, and the pencil
better than
is
I could draw it.
Making marks on the paper. But it's not itself in time. I think you can make sense of that on the B theory, because you see what this does, and this is telling David, is this makes time a sort of spatial dimension. It's all strung out there in front of you, and so the being in the higher dimension can interact with anything on that surface. But that just is to presuppose that time is a sort of B theory, where things in time are all equally existent, and therefore the being who is outside of time can interact with them. So I think that that analogy really does illustrate very well the sort of theory of time. Now you say, but wait a minute, isn't the pencil moving here? Isn't it? And therefore there would be time there. Well, that would mean that God doesn't exist timelessly. That would make God exist in a kind of hyper-time, you know, a sort of a second time dimension, which doesn't gain you anything. You've only moved him from our time dimension to a higher time dimension. So I think that analogy really does support what I said, that it's going to mean you've got to be a B theorist, right? Okay, somebody else.
Okay, I might be saying sort of what he was saying, but again, with you were saying the A theory indicates that God is not necessarily timeless, that he exists in time. But if when God created the universe and human beings, he created time for them to dwell inside of, it seems like that he could look down upon time and see and recognize current time as it goes along the timeline. Anything, but still be above time, still be timeless. It doesn't seem mutually exclusive.
Okay, now, let's think about what Ben has said here. It seems to me that what he is trying to do is combine the A and the B theory into a kind of what I call A-B theory, a quasi-theory. And what this would be is to say that past, present, and future are all equally real, but that the present kind of moves along the timeline, like a spotlight moving along a row of pilings or something. And so this is the way that the now moves across the timeline. Now, I talk about this in the book. I think that that really is incoherent in the end, unless you posit a higher second time dimension. Because if the now really is moving across the timeline, then there's a second time dimension in which the now is moving, because the now is at every moment in the timeline, right? It goes through across all of them. So if you say it first is here, then it's here, then it's here, you posit a kind of second time dimension in which the lapse of the first dimension is taking place. And so that really, anywhere again, it would mean that God would have to be either in the hyper-time dimension, in which case he's still temporal, or if he's not, he can't know what time the moving now is on. Because if he knows the moving now is now at 2008, then he's temporally located himself. He could only know that the moving now is at every point in the timeline, unless you introduce the sort of second time dimension, it seems to me. Yeah, Ted.
I'm definitely interested in the B theory or somewhere even outside of that one. But because God describes himself as the Alpha Omega, the beginning and the end. And like in Psalm 139, it says, all of my days are numbered before there's even one of them. And it says, God knows my entire life. My days are already written in his book. So if my days are written in his book already, he knows I'm going to die when I'm 86 or whatever it might be. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. If he knows I'm going to die when I'm 86, then he will also know every prayer that I'm going to pray between now and 86 and every response he will have to that.
Right.
So from God's standpoint, that's done. See, I could face life not worried if I wasn't such a worry, but I could.
Yeah.
I could face life saying everything between now and the end of my life has already been fixed and set and done by God. So God, to me, is outside of this timeline that moves along with me. He doesn't walk along and say, gosh, oh, Ted needs a truck. He didn't like that. 3 years, he said, Ted needs a truck. He's going to get a Ford. I got him a Ford, you know, and whatever it is. I really believe that because I just think, he's sitting outside of the beginning, the end, and the middle. He's outside of all of those. To him, they're all at the same time.
Okay. What Ted has done is to tie in our discussion of divine eternity very nicely with the discussion of God's omniscience, which we'll get to. You did. It was a beautiful segue. When we want to talk about God's foreknowledge of the future, we have to agree, I think, as biblical Christians, that God knows when we're going to die. He knows the prayers that we will pray. He knows the answers that he will give. I entirely agree. The question, however, Ted, is does he know these things because they exist out there and he timelessly sees them, so to speak, and so he knows what's going to happen? Or is it rather that God knows what will happen in the future, but it's not because he looks and sees that it's already done. It's because he knows that this is the way you will freely act, and he will act in response in a certain way. And these aren't the same view. These are two quite different views of God's knowledge of the future.
Heaven right now is saying, you remember back when you was in that class, you was trying to explain to them and you was having so much trouble. You was right and they were all wrong.
Okay. Yeah, Liz.
Hi. All right. I probably cannot express myself quite as coherently as you can, but I
Go ahead.
All right. But I'm undecided as to which theory I really believe in, but I do think that God cannot exist temporarily, because if he was bound by time, when he is interacting with the world through his miracles, he would be bound by, I think time is something that really set in the laws of science and nature that God can break. Just because he is inherently timeless, he exists outside of time, he exists outside of any laws of science that we know. I believe that as soon as he enters that temporal state, he would be bound by time as we are, and that's the reason why we die, why we cannot do what he does.
Well, now, let me say a couple of things in response to this. I certainly think we want to say that God isn't bound by scientific laws. He could have created a universe operating according to totally different laws. But when we're talking about his relationship to time, this isn't a matter of scientific law. This is metaphysics. It's not physics, it's metaphysics. And so it really doesn't have anything to do with God's being bound by science. The question I think here is this, is it true that having a temporal mode of existence is binding oneself in the way you described? Is this limiting oneself? I'm not sure that language isn't kind of emotionally loaded. In one sense, becoming temporal is a way of liberating oneself to act and to react, to have intercourse with other persons, to be responsive and active. A timeless being is a being that is frozen into immobility, that cannot change in any way, lest a before and after should exist. So in some ways, I mean, I think this is basically an emotional matter here. In some ways, you could think of God's entering into time as God's bursting out into this tremendous activity in creating a world and interacting with it and so forth. Let me just say one more thing, and I would say this. I also think that a way of thinking of this is as an act of condescension on God's part. That in creating a temporal world, God condescends to give up his mode of atemporal existence and to take on our temporal mode of existence for our sake and our salvation. And then in the incarnation, he condescends even further to take on not merely our mode of existence, but our very humanity. And I think that's very characteristic of the biblical God, a God who humbles himself and condescends to take on our mode of existence and our humanity. Okay, you have the last word, and then you need to close.
You do present a convincing argument, but I would have to respectfully disagree, because I do believe... I do believe that God, as you said earlier, if he did before creation exist timelessly outside of time, and you say that that prevents him from changing, then how did he change in order to create the universe? And in the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was with God.
All right. You come 2 weeks from today and bring that question up, because that's a good question, a good objection that needs to be answered. So, let me just say these are controversial issues. As I said, this is not a biblical issue on which one goes to the wall. And so you're entirely at liberty to disagree with what I present here without being unbiblical in any way. I'm not presenting this as biblical truth, but as my best effort to make sense of a biblical truth that God is eternal. What we'll do next time then is continue this discussion, because I think it is worthwhile, and then we'll look at some application to our lives of God's being eternal. So, till then.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.